Welcome to the Catapult Ed Next Gen podcast, a podcast to educate the next generation towards a successful financial future. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest podcast edition for Catapult Ed Next Gen, the podcast where we continue to try and educate the younger generation, the 18 to 35-year-olds that are asking all the questions about their finances. And today, it's a pleasure to have Greg Samuel, Director of Samuel Finance, with us, and Dylan Evans, who's a Senior Financial Planner at Catapult Wealth. And today we're going to talk all things in borrowing to invest and what are the pros and cons of that and how that all works. So welcome, gents. You know, it's obviously we've had a podcast on borrowing to buy your home, which I think is a completely different issue. This is with maybe not necessarily just that younger generation, but perhaps into your 30s, you're starting to think about, well, could I borrow to put a share portfolio together? Could I borrow to buy another investment property? Could I borrow to buy a commercial property? And even today, I want to cover off on perhaps borrowing to invest in your super fund, in a self-managed super fund. So there's various things that I think someone in their 30s or late 20s might start to ask. And I'm assuming that I know that, for example, that you both come across it quite regularly. Greg, I'll start with you. Well, firstly, are you seeing younger people? Is there a certain demographic you do come across that start looking at borrowing to invest in residential property or in different types of investments? Do you find that trend? There's any trends there?
Yeah. G'day, Tony, and thanks for having me.
Pleasure, appreciate mate.
Appreciate it. Look, I guess younger people are always starting off with their first home, which tends to be they're living in it. So I guess the initial stage of looking for an investment property tends to be, I guess, your mid-20s for people who are sort of ahead of the game.
Yep.
And then after that, it's really a variety of people. You know, property is becoming a very appealing investment to a lot of people, right through to older age people. Mm-hmm. You know, the interest rates are so cheap at the moment, so, mm-hmm. you know, you're borrowing to invest at you know, sort of mid twos for investment. Mm-hmm. If you're happy to pay principal and interest, so yeah, people across all walks of life and all age groups are really looking at investment property now. And if you can earn a 4 or 5% yield,
yep.
and you're paying sort of mid twos, then it really starts to make
tipped
sense.
In favor, yeah.
You know, people used to love the negative gearing aspects of property. That used to be all the rage, whereas these days, it's you know, if you've got a negatively geared property, it's probably not such a good investment.
You're purposefully losing money.
Yeah.
I guess just jumping down that rabbit hole for a little moment then, has the banking environment, either with COVID or even before it with the Royal Commission, has their attitude towards lending for investment purposes, say for residential property, has it changed, or where does it sit today in terms of the things they're looking for?
I'm not sure that they're attitude has changed towards investment lending. I mean, the government did put restrictions on the banks as to how much investment lending they could do, and that was going back probably a couple of years ago.
Yep.
That's when we saw the tiered sort of interest rate structure get introduced, where owner-occupied properties are lower interest rates mm-hmm. than investment properties. So yeah, but those restrictions have since been lifted by government. So, mm-hmm. but the banks have held onto that, interest rate structure. So, typically, there's four main categories of interest rates. There's owner occupied and investment. Owner occupied is cheaper than investment, mm-hmm. And interest only and principal and interest. Mm-hmm. Principal and interest is a lower rate than interest only. So basically, you're priced for risk. So, yeah, the government restrictions have been lifted, but the banks still have a preference for owner-occupied lending, just on that risk basis. Mm. I think they would have a lower default rate on their books on owner-occupied lending. But I think, you know, they're still open to doing investment lending, and the lending parameters are more or less the same. They've probably become a little bit more conservative over the last sort of 12 months, and we still get to the same outcome, but we're just jumping through a lot more hoops to get there.
So they're mainly looking then at less at the LVR of what you're going to borrow on it and more at your cash flow though now in terms of what is your ability to repay that loan?
I mean, they're the two core factors that they look at for assessing loans. Both are important factors, I suppose. The core assessment of a loan is always the ability to repay it because no bank wants to have an issue where the customers can't repay their loans. Mm. So that's the primary assessment.
Mm.
And then the LVR, that's sort of the backup plan for the bank, I suppose. But but the banks are quite reluctant to realise on defaulting loans. So, yeah, it's always a focus on the ability to repay. Yeah, and since coronavirus, we're starting to get a little bit more focus on people's job security, whether that's been affected by coronavirus, their business income if they're self-employed. Because, of course, typically you look back at the last 2 years to work out the servicing of a loan for a self-employed person, but we're in a period which may not relate at all to the last 2 years. So, they're probably paying a little bit more attention to that. But, yeah, primarily they're looking at the income side of things.
Do they, and that's a really good point, Greg, is that they do, so they're not only focused on the risk management or the stress testing, I suppose I call it, of, you know, how, what's your job security like or your income stream to repay the loan. But I assume do they pay any attention to what rent you could or get, or, you know, if you don't have a tenant for 6 months, or do they pay much attention to that side of the equation?
So when we're doing an investment loan, we will include a potential rent and that is typically set by the valuer.
Yep.
So the valuer will do a valuation and say, this is the market rent, this is the market value.
Yep.
So because vacancy rates have been so low in Australia, you know, sort of 1% or so in the rental market, it's just sort of a given that that will be the rental income.
Yep.
But, yeah, they probably, I think since the coronavirus, there has been a bit of an upheaval in the rental market. Mm. And we are also seeing sort of Airbnb properties that were run as Airbnbs coming back into the rental market. I think there was an initial influx when the coronavirus hit and all the international tourists cancelled their trips and that.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me if they do start to look more at the risk of whether it gets rented. And they would have a look at your, you know, if you're buying a property and it's not tenanted, then they would look at it and say, well, can you afford to make your repayments for the next sort of 2 or 3 months if it's not rented? That would be a general consideration, but it's not really a policy thing we deal with.
So. Yeah. I mean, I think that some of these things from Dylan and my perspective, from a financial planning aspect, would be important because we generally have a saying of don't be a forced seller of any asset. So even if the bank will give you the money, we still don't want clients to get themselves into trouble from a cash flow point of view. So these are some of the stress tests that we would probably do as financial planners and give advice on as well. So even above and beyond the bank and in terms of protecting their income, which we're not here today to talk about. But just going back a step as well, Greg, while I've got you, is can you explain the tier process? How much of a differential in interest rates do you see from, you know, I mean, we've seen home loan rates as low as, I don't know, about 2% at the moment, probably give or take. And then, you know, if you're an investor loan versus, and also interest only versus P&I, are you talking 0.5% differential, or where are we at with the difference?
Yeah, I mean, for most of the sort of mainstream lenders, the lowest rates are around the 2.19, maybe 2.09. Mm. That's primarily on the fixed rates.
Yep.
So when the RBA had their last rate cut, the banks all agreed to pass it all on to their fixed rates as opposed to their variable rates. That's why we're now seeing, you know, the 2.19 fixed, but, you know, a variable equivalent variable rate would be 2.5, 2.6.
Yeah.
Sort of best in market. But yeah, so from owner occupier to investor, you're probably looking at 0.3 to 0.4% difference.
Okay.
And then from P&I to interest only, you're looking about the same, 0.3 to 0.4. So best in market, you're looking at 2.09, 2.19
fixed.
For owner occupied, principal and interest fixed.
Yep.
For the equivalent in investment, I think it's I did have a look this morning. There's a few outliers, but yeah, so the best in the investment market was 2.39 this morning.
Okay.
That was a 1-year fixed rate, but that was a bit of an outlier. But yeah, generally speaking, you look at it 0.3, 0.4% higher for whether you're owner, occupier, investor, or P&I interest only.
If and Dylan, sorry to mate, I'm going to ask you a question in a minute, so I will come to you, but I just want to ask Greg one last question. You're a young couple, you're looking at buying an investment property. What sort of time frames would you allow for someone to come in and meet someone like yourself or your team before they could then commit to going and buying an investment property? So what would you probably recommend that people out there look at in terms of times?
Well, I mean, are you talking about doing a pre-approval?
And even how you would do it. Is a pre-approval the right way to go? Or, yeah, I guess I'd be looking for your feedback there.
Well, I guess, firstly, in terms of timeframes, to come and see us, we work pretty quickly, like my office.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that always holds us up is, you know, getting the right information from clients, which that probably takes the most time. But if we get everything in from a client, we might take a week by the time we pick it up, put it all together and have it ready to go, have the application form signed and everything ready to lodge. Once it gets to the lender, then it's sort of how long's a piece of string.
Yeah.
So the worst sort of turnarounds we're seeing at the moment is anywhere up to sort of 30 plus business days.
Yeah, wow.
Which is, you know, that's not every lender, and they do prioritise, you know, purchase settlements versus refinances or pre-approvals. They'll get pushed down the priority list. And then if you do an application, the more complicated it is, the more likely you're going to have backwards and forwards questions, which, you know, worst case scenario, you could be looking at a 2-month approval process.
Yeah, yeah.
It has become a much bigger consideration for us how long it's going to take a lender to pick it up, which, you know, people don't always like that. They don't always want to look at the cheapest rate and go with that. But if you've got a purchase settlement, or a finance clause coming up, then you really have to take that into consideration.
Absolutely.
So, but then there are some lenders which are doing turning things around quite quickly. We had one that we turned around in 2 or 3 days this week. It was a bit of a surprise for us at the moment.
No offence to Macquarie Bank.
Yeah. And but also one of the factors contributing to this is a lot of lenders are offering refinance rebates at the moment, which is essentially you refinance your loan and they'll pay you $2,000, sometimes $4,000, sometimes $2,000 per property. So if you've got
switch over.
Yeah, if you've got 3 or 4 investment properties, it's a big chunk of money.
Yeah, wow.
The problem with that is that you get everyone rushed to those banks That's when the time frames blow out.
So the earlier you can get in and have a chat with someone like your team, the better, I suspect, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And, yeah, on the pre-approval question, particularly if you're looking to buy investment properties, I'd say it's a good idea because it's good to know, A, how much you can afford and what you're sort of aiming for.
Yep.
But, B, if you can have a pre-approved limit and make an unconditional offer, you're in a much stronger position to negotiate a decent price. So.
That pre-approved, that has a certain time frame they pre-approve it for. Is it sort of in existence for a certain time frame, isn't it?
Yeah, different between lenders. It's typically 3 months to 6 months.
Okay.
And you got to be careful because some of them are 6 months from when you lodge the application, which if it takes 6 weeks to put together, it's chewing into that time.
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree. Dylan, over to you, mate. And we've been talking about investing in residential property. Quite clearly, there are other asset classes you can borrow to invest in. And the one that particularly I just want to ask you about is borrowing to invest in the share market.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, there are two probably primary ways that we come across that you could do that. Is you can borrow against your if you had an existing principal place residence, you can do probably a split loan, as I think the definition would be, Greg, of how you do that, and use your primary place residence as collateral for that loan. And the other way is margin lending. Can you just explain maybe some of the broad differences between the two, and particularly how the two may work, and what are the pros and cons?
Yeah, so margin lending is, I suppose, a little bit different to property lending in the sense that, you know, when you apply for your margin loan, you know, similar to your process with your bank, with a residential property is you know, you apply for a certain amount. So you might say, you know, for your margin loan, it's 100 grand.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially it works a lot like a line of credit where that's your drawing ability. Mm-hmm. And you can use that money to go and invest in shares. So what most people will do is, you know, if they're starting a margin loan, they might put down 50,000 of their own money.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go to the margin lender and request, you know, another 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then they use that to go and buy shares.
A share portfolio, yeah.
Now, one of the big differences between property and shares is obviously, you know, you can quite easily get in and out of shares.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you'll use that credit. You know, you'll slowly build your portfolio up.
Mm.
You know, occasionally you'll draw it down to buy more shares, or you'll, you know, sell shares and the loan will drop.
Mm.
And generally, you know, they'll have an interest rate. It's a little bit higher than your residential property that is attached to that, and the shares form the security for the loan.
So you don't. So technically, yeah, you don't have to put a property on the hook for it. If things go pear-shaped, it's the share portfolio itself that's the collateral for that loan. And the interest rate differential, I mean, it's reasonably substantial. I mean, it's probably around 4-5% for a margin loan, is it?
Yeah, you'll find. I mean, if you look them all up, they'll all advertise at the moment at you know, 5.5, 6.5. And it really does depend on the size of the loan.
Yep.
You know, if you're quite a small investor and you're only going to be borrowing 50 grand.
Yeah.
You're not going to have much negotiating power there, but you can certainly, you know, push them down into the fours at this point in time.
Mm.
But there will certainly be, you know, quite a substantial difference between, you know, what you'll pay on a residential loan and a margin loan.
Yep. And as I understand it, you just can't go and borrow the money from a margin lender, though, and buy also whatever you want. You can't go and buy XYZ mining shares. There's certain lists, I think, approved lists that they have.
Yep. So, you know, similar to a property, the bank is willing to lend you a certain amount based on the assets that you buy.
Yeah.
So you'll find, you know, if you're buying Woolworths shares, they'll generally be willing to lend you up to 75% of the value of those shares.
Yep.
Now, if you go out and buy Rex Minerals or, you know, Afterpay or something like that, they might only allow you to borrow 35%. So, you know, you've got a limit in terms of how much they're willing to lend you,
mm-hmm.
but they've also in the background, they look at the portfolio of assets that you've bought and, you know, apply those percentages to work out, you know, how much of that limit they're willing to lend you based on those assets.
So diversification within the portfolio is still an issue.
Yep. So you will find you have limits. You know, you can't go and buy exactly what you want.
No.
You can only have a certain amount in each investment and you have to, you know, buy certain investments. Otherwise, your ability to borrow is less.
Yep, agreed. In terms of, you know, again, the flexibility around that is probably some of the advantages. We said a disadvantage might be the higher interest rate.
Yep.
Liquidity is a fairly good advantage. Transaction costs probably a bit cheaper as well. But the other advantage that I've seen with this is you can sort of start small, I suppose, is the other comment I wanted to make, is that it's not like a property purchase where it's sort of it's a $500,000 decision nearly straight off the bat. You can start with a $40,000 or $50,000 portfolio, I assume. You can really start that small.
And that's one of the biggest benefits. I mean, when you're talking property, it might be 500 grand and you'll pay stamp duty and, you know, you might have, you know, 30-40 of grand of costs tied up in that purchase. And obviously it's something that you're wanting to be, you know, in there for 5 or 10 years at a minimum. The margin loan, especially for, you know, potentially younger people that aren't going to be buying a property anytime soon, it's an option for them. Or just if you're looking to, you know, start with something smaller than an investment property, it lets you do 50 grand and maybe put $1,000 in every month, which is an option that you can't do with property just because of the costs. And if you ever need to get out of it for whatever reason, you know, it's relatively easy to, you know, sell up and say goodbye to the loan and be done with it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Greg, when you're investing in property and you would have, you've been in this industry now for a fair while, different types of investment borrowing structures. So I assume you come across a lot of people that buy it in their own names, partners' names, joint names, trusts, everything, I suppose. Do you come across, there's no one size fits all approach here, is it just really dependent on the situation?
Yeah, I think most people would, if, you know, going for a first investment property, will look to buy in their personal names, I'd say.
Yeah.
It's a simple structure. You get all the tax benefits, like negative gearing. We said perhaps it doesn't apply much anymore, but you get that in your personal name. You get the capital gains discounts.
Yes.
Relatively low administration costs. It's just an extra section in your income tax return.
Yep.
So that would probably be the most common. When people are starting to get a little bit more sophisticated, they look towards the family trusts.
Mm-hmm.
The family trusts, the main benefit is being able to distribute the profits, as you would know, around the family, which can help minimise tax.
Yep.
You don't get the negative gearing because you can't distribute losses from a trust.
Yep.
And then you have the extra administrative costs. You've got to do financials and tax returns for a trust. So whether or not there's enough benefit in it for you then depends on how big an investor you are, I suppose. But, yeah, they're probably the main two structures we'd see. Never really see companies because companies are paying 27.5% tax off the bat.
Yep.
They don't get the capital gains tax discount.
No.
And, you know, perhaps every now and then we might see a unit trust, very rarely.
Yeah.
And that's probably more the case if it wasn't family members investing together and then they have a distinct proportion of the profit and the shareholding of the property.
Yep.
But, yeah, that's a pretty rare occasion that we'd see that.
While we're talking about structures to invest, then are you seeing, I mean, I think there's, I personally am seeing more 30 to 45-year-olds, particularly married couples now, probably saved up a bit through super guarantee now, 8 or 9 or 10%'s gone into the super fund for a good 10 years. They combine, they set up a self-managed super fund and go and invest in a property. Are you seeing more and more of a trend towards that, you know, using those LRBA arrangements in an SMSF? Are you personally seeing more of that activity in that younger demographic?
Oh, look, maybe 5 years ago we saw quite a lot of it.
Yeah, okay.
Since then, the banks have really pulled back on the lending. So I might have had 10 or so lenders, a good chunk, maybe two or three of the major lenders used to do it. Now no major lenders will do it. There's probably three or four lenders that will do SMSF lending and they charge accordingly.
When you say they charge accordingly, are we talking 6 or 7% here or?
Well, it can be as in the sixes.
Yeah.
5 to 6 or so. And then you've also got the setup costs of setting up the, you know, the bare trust to hold the property and, you know, the banks will charge you to review the structure and make sure it's all rigid-edge and, we're probably not seeing as much of it. We get a lot of queries on it, but once people find out the costs, it sort of puts a bullet in it. So
go the other way. A question without notice, Greg, do you have any view, or Dylan, do you have any view of why the banks pulled out of that SMSF lending market? Did it just get too hard for them or the compliance was regime was too poor?
Yeah, I haven't heard of, you know, the structure being tested too much.
No.
As in people defaulting and the banks having to sell. I haven't even heard of a single loan. There's probably some out there. I don't think it was that. I think they are perhaps concerned if it does get tested how it would play out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just think, you know, banks have really become sausage factories, I suppose, with this, you know, residential lending. And the effort and the cost and all the admin of these loans is just not worth what they're probably making on them. Yeah, so, okay.
A relatively small market, I would imagine.
Yeah.
They just don't play.
Mm.
Yeah, no, fair enough. It's certainly, I mean, I must admit, I'm still seeing activity in that market borrowing to invest for farming land.
Yep.
And you know, Greg, you and I have done arrangements around that. And also I've seen activity in that market around commercial property, probably less so resi, but commercial property, and particularly where it's structurally important, maybe where they're renting it from themselves for their business.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to go do something and it become form part of a longer term retirement plan or something like that. I'm still seeing activity or enough activity around that in SMSF land as well.
Mm.
In terms of Dylan, going back to you then, in investing against your prop, you're using your property though as collateral to invest, say, in the share market.
Yep.
A lot of people don't understand. They think, well, if I use my home as collateral, therefore it's a non-deductible loan, but that's not the case.
No, I mean, the deductibility of your loan is essentially based on what you use that money to do. So you can certainly go, and the reason that you'd consider this is because the interest rate is so good.
Yeah.
If you've got equity in your home or an investment property or something like that in your portfolio, you can go out and borrow against that. You'll get a very cheap interest rate in comparison to margin lending or some of the other options.
Yeah.
And even on top of that, you know, if your shares, as they do, you know, move around a bit, unlike a margin loan, and it's not something we've covered, but if your shares move around, there's not necessarily any risk that the bank's going to require you to sell any of those shares or anything like that. So there's a bit less risk there. The interest rate's a bit lower. And as long as you, you know, generally set up a separate facility so that it's clearly marked away from your other loan, it's tax deductible as long as you use it to invest.
Yeah. Are those split loans relatively easy to set up, Greg?
Basic Ag.
Yeah.
We do that all the time. Depending on which lender you go to, they may want you to pay investment interest rates.
Okay.
How we were talking, you know, owner-occupied versus investment, different pricing.
Yep.
But if you go to the right lender, then they'll let you do the owner-occupied rates. So
yeah, that's good.
Can be quite attractive with the right lender.
Yeah, I mean, in this environment, I find myself having that conversation, as you two gentlemen might also be having, is that with owner-occ rates at 2.19 or thereabouts, Greg, as you mentioned, it means what I call the hurdle rate, the hurdle to beat investing in something else, is not that high anymore. Mm. And so to break even, as you said, or positively gear something can become an interesting proposition now.
Mm.
And but clearly marking it, Dylan, as you say, and making sure that your accountant is clear on not blending non-deductible debt and deductible debt, and making sure that you understand what you should be moving around and where all that money's come from is really important. You know, but I certainly have seen an uptick in that sort of activity now as well. And 2.19 as an interest rate versus, you know, 5 or 6% for a margin loan or 6 or 7% for a SMSF loan it makes the game a bit different from an interest rate point of view. Greg, when people come and see you and they're looking to invest get a loan to invest, what sort of documentation or what sort of evidence are you having to walk them through and what do they need to bring?
Yeah, well, these days you got to bring the colour of your undies a little bit, but it's everything you'd probably expect most people if they've borrowed money before. You know, we need to provide evidence of income, so pay slips, maybe payment summaries. I think they've changed the name of them recently, but tax returns, notices of assessment. If you're self-employed, then financials, tax returns, notices of assessment, and then, you know, your ID documentation, passport and license pretty much covers it. What else? I mean, anything else that's relevant to the deal, contract of sale. If you were borrowing to get cash out for shares, they may want evidence of that. What would that look like? Perhaps a letter from your financial planner.
Okay. Yep.
And statements have become a big thing. So, I mean, they always were, but now pretty much you have to provide at least 1 month statement for every account, credit card, loan that you have.
Oh, okay, yep.
And typically at least 6 months of any loan that you're going to refinance. And with your transaction statements and credit cards, they will sort of, most lenders these days are going through it line item by line item just to marry up your living expenses with what you're actually spending.
Yep.
Living expenses get scrutinised quite a lot these days. There are some lenders that don't do as much scrutiny, but they will have they'll tend to have a higher benchmark rate when they're assessing your loan.
Yep.
So your sensitised interest rate when they're doing their calculations. And or they'll have a higher minimum living expenses.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's – so what I'm probably hearing, Greg, is that be prepared to be ready, I suppose, is you know, it's not like I'll walk in and just fill out a form and there's a fair bit of evidence and documentation that's needed behind it. And just on the tax return, I know that you mentioned that before, is that you know, so if we're in – what are we in? September, October at the moment – Is there a requirement? Is there an expectation you'll need your, you know, your 19-20 tax return to get a loan at the moment, or will they accept your 2019 tax return? How do they approach that?
Most lenders will have just a rule that they go by. So typically we can use 2019's out to probably December this year.
Yeah, rightio.
Some lenders will be looking at March. Some lenders would, it's December, but, you know, if you provide management accounts or some other form of verification, then then we can get a little bit of leniency. But, yeah, typically it's
6 months lag.
Well, yeah, 6 months past the next financial year.
Yeah, so it's an 18-month lag technically. Yep. Yeah, okay. And that's good to know. Do either of you gentlemen have – I get asked a lot about either both for homeowners and for investment going variable versus locking in. And I also get asked a lot about interest only versus principal and interest. Dylan, I'll ask you first. Do you have any particular view on what people need to weigh up when they're looking at those things, or, you know, is there any particular tricks there?
Yeah, I mean, look, traditionally, I've always looked at as variable was probably the starting point because, and it, as you say, it might be changing a little bit now simply because it's generally been the cheaper of the options.
Yeah.
And I've tended to look towards fixed more as an option if it's important that the repayments are going to be steady. So potentially if there's cash flow issues, if things are particularly tight, or there's a reason why there's a requirement for the repayments to be steady, I tend to look at fixed. Otherwise, I tend to, you know, look towards variable simply because historically there's been a bit of a gap between variable being lower than fixed.
Yeah.
And if you run the numbers over a year or two, you generally come out ahead with variable, assuming there's no significant moves to the interest rates.
Mm.
In terms of, you know, principal and interest, I think that's very much depends on the in some ways what you're trying to achieve and the kind of person you are.
Mm.
Certainly, you know, principal and interest does have that benefit of, regardless of what you're doing, you know, that loan's going down, and in 10, 15 years, it just has a habit of getting itself repaid. Whereas, you know, interest only, if you're not being very conscious of what you're doing with it, then, you know, it can be something that you get down the road. And if you haven't got capital growth on your property and you still have a loan the same size, it can potentially, you know, cause a few issues down the road.
Mm.
But obviously, you know, if you run the numbers again and have deductible interest, then, you know, interest only is pretty attractive because you maximise, you know, that deduction there.
Yep, agreed. Greg, do you have any view on both of those?
We're doing quite a lot of split loans at the moment.
Yep. Yep.
So I tend to say always leave enough variable to allow for your offset.
Yep.
Plus any lump sums you're planning to make within a fixed rate period. And of course, don't fix if you're planning to possibly sell a property, because then you might be up for break costs.
Agreed.
But other than that, I tend to move towards having a blend where you can sort of maximise the interest savings with a fixed rate, so have a lower rate, and then keep some variable to have some flexibility there for offsets and redraws. In terms of how you'd structure that with investment versus owner-occupied, so say you've got a home loan and you're looking to get cash out for investment, then I would tend to fix the investment.
Yes.
Because
you don't want to pay off faster.
You don't want to pay it off faster. You don't need to offset it because you'd rather offset your non-tax deductible debt.
Correct.
So that's where I would normally allocate my fixed rate.
Yep.
And
pay the just home loan off as fast as you can.
Yeah. And also I always tell clients, make the most of offset accounts.
Yes.
I always tell people to be quite cautious about using redraw because, as we were saying before, the tax deductibility is related to the purpose of the loan. Mm. So if you pay down your investment loan and then redraw it to buy a jet ski, that chunk is no longer tax deductible.
That's
so
right.
Whereas if you parked in an offset account, buy a jet ski, then that's, you know, the loan hasn't actually changed. It's just the offset's changed. So.
Spot on. That's very good advice. Appreciate that. In terms of just what we're talking about interest only, the banks just don't let you go interest only forever though, do they? Or do they, I mean, or do they? Do they have a certain time frame where they like to see a bit of principal paid off?
Yeah, I mean, typically we can get out to 5 years pretty easily.
Okay.
And you used to be able to just basically fill out a form and extend that, but those days are gone now.
Yeah.
The banks are making a lot more, well, paying a lot more attention to your age these days as well. So if within the 30-year loan term you're going to be at retirement age, they'll want to know how you plan to repay that loan.
Yeah.
So you can't just keep going interest only forever.
No.
You get more flexibility from different lenders, but then we always need to have an explanation on the exit strategy of the loan, which, you know, quite often sale of the property is a reasonable explanation.
Greg, this is a question I only got asked yesterday, so it was again without notice, is parental guarantee. And I don't know whether, Dylan, you come across and you might have a view on this as well, but I got asked an interesting question yesterday about, well, if a parent goes as guarantor for a child, what impact does that have on their lending, or does that go into the blend of their lending ratios or cash flow ratios? How does that work? Sorry for that terrible question, but
no, that's right. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, so if they're providing a parental guarantee, it's essentially topping up their child's mortgage with a mortgage against their property. So obviously you've got to have both loans at the same lender, otherwise
there's a good start. Yeah.
Yeah, because the banks won't tend to want to sit second mortgage behind someone else.
Yeah.
They lose a bit of control in the mortgage. So they are restricted with lenders that they can use. And this does come up every now and then where mum and dad have given a guarantee to help their son or daughter buy a property, and then they decide they want to sell that property or do something else, borrow more money, and it can become an issue.
Yeah.
Which, you know, normally gets sorted out, but it might take a month or two to work through it. So it is something to keep in mind. We always recommend that as soon as you get to the point where you can release the property, get it released.
Yeah.
Because that just saves those problems later on.
Yeah. So it's not just a matter of signing a piece of paper saying, I'm signing it for my daughter and I'll just make sure that she's okay. There's actually, I'm part of the credit process.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And different lenders require different amounts of information. Obviously, if the parent's providing a guarantee, they need to identify them and they would be signing a mortgage, so all the rigmarole that goes through that.
Yep.
Some will only, in terms of the assessment, only really need a statement of assets and liabilities, and they'll just want to see that they're not going to put them out on their, on their own if they have to call up the loan. Whereas other lenders will want a full assessment on the parents as well.
Yep.
In turn, most of the time we see like just equity plays. So they're essentially topping up the equity.
Yeah.
I think the main one we deal with for income is ANZ will allow a little bit of support on the income side of things as well. So
yeah.
But that's few and far between.
No, fair enough. I think it's interesting information, and it's really important that parents know what they're getting themselves into if they go down this path. Greg gave some pretty good advice before just around redraw and offset accounts. Do you have anything to add around, you know, how you've approached redraw or offset yourself on top of what Greg said?
I think it's just echoing what he said. I mean, I think the offset can be a fantastic tool. You know, give you that flexibility to park money in the offset. You know, you get an inheritance and it lands, you can park it in the offset for 6 months while you work out what you're going to do.
Yep.
And then, you know, you can draw it out again really easily. I'm not sure if it, we'll see it in the future, but it was interesting to see the treatment around the redraw and offset recently, which was quickly wound back, but some of the banks, the redraw disappeared.
Yep.
In the recent, crisis, whereas the offset was still available.
Yes.
You know, I think they're very cautious about messing with that, but it just shows the offset is essentially just a bank account that you can access at will and use for what you choose. Whereas, you know, the redraw is much closer to repaying the loan and then requesting money back.
Yeah.
It's a great way to, save a bit of interest by parking funds that you're not necessarily going to use in the short term in that account.
Yep. Greg, do all banks offer, are offset accounts now just normal? Like, is that just a standard feature on a lot of loan products?
No, that you'll have generally two tiers of products. So you have your basic products, which typically all have a redraw facility. They're low fees. They tend to be very low interest rates, probably better than the packaged products. But it's sort of a no-frills loan that you're getting. And then when you move into the package products, that's where you'll pay an annual fee.
Yep.
Typically $395 a year. You'll get offset account, fee-free credit card with some lenders, and a discount off the standard variable rate. Still probably not as good as the basic rate, but yeah, it's just a more complete package. We would mainly do package products.
Yeah, okay.
I'd say the basic products work well for, you know, first home buyers. They're not going to have a lot of money to park in an offset.
Yep.
They just want the cheapest rate and a simple facility.
Gentlemen, are there any other bells or whistles that you would be looking for in a package product then, or if from a lender that, you know, redraw, offset, great. Is there any other bells or whistles that you'd be looking for?
For me personally, not really. We do. I get a lot of borrowers who love the credit cards with points.
Frequent flyer, I was going to say that.
I always say, look, it's just smoke and mirrors. If you work out the actual value of the points, but
yeah,
I think it's a bit like playing pokies. People get addicted to
it. Yeah, free gift every 6 months. Yeah.
But I mean, all things being equal, if you get, you know, something for nothing, it's better.
Yeah.
But you just got to take it with a pinch of salt.
So. Yeah, yeah. Mm. There's nothing else, Dylan, that you would look for?
No, I think, you know, when you, as you say, with the points and things, if you got to take into account, you know, the rates and things you're getting, are they going to be worth a lot more than some of those little bells and whistles? So, no, I don't think there's anything specifically that I'd look for.
Gents, is there any other thing if there's people out there that are looking at, you know, trying to grow their wealth, you know, and you know, the markets are, you know, cheap to invest, cheap to borrow in at the moment, as you say, Craig. You know, is it something? Is there any other factors that you both would recommend, or any other tips or tricks that you would have up your sleeve, just to say, right, well, either pitfalls that you would avoid, or things that you would offer to all our audience out there around in borrowing to invest?
Yeah, well, obviously you've got to make sure you're buying the right property.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a minefield out there. There's a lot of property advisors who would like to give you advice, but you've got to be careful that they're not just selling some developer's stock at high commission. So
yep.
If you're going to use someone like that, make sure they're reputable.
Yep.
So buying the right property is probably the main risk.
Buy a good quality asset.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got you there, Greg. It's interesting. So just understanding the motivation behind who you're buying the property from is what you're trying to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, in the past, we haven't seen too much of it lately, but there has been occasions where you'll get a large-scale developer that pays agents to spruik their property.
Yeah.
And they're often getting paid inflated commissions,
yeah,
you know, up to 5% versus the normal sort of 1.5 to 2.
Yep.
And that can cause you issues when you come to settle.
Okay.
Because if the valuers are aware that the agents have been paid over market commissions, they may deduct that off your valuation.
Right.
You may find that you end up needing to put more money into a deal to make it happen.
Yeah.
And no one really likes hearing that their asset's worth less than what they paid for it when it comes to settle. So,
not a good start.
Yeah, be very careful of that stuff.
No, I appreciate that. Dylan, did you have any tips or tricks?
I mean, it's probably similar. I mean, I've seen, you know, some of the pitfalls have been, you know, potentially people that bought apartments or things like that where, you know, probably the investment case wasn't quite as good as it would have been with another asset. And I think you've got to be careful about getting drawn in by some of the tax advantages with some of these investments. You know, don't invest for, you know, negative gearing is probably the great example. But, you know, tax advantages are great, but they're not the reason to be doing the investment. And certainly, you know, if you're talking margin lending or things like that, I would just say, you know, have a manageable loan. You know, whenever you're borrowing, just make sure that, you know, if rates go up, if things happen, you know, someone loses their job, whatever it might be, that you've got a plan, you know, how to deal with that. And then there's a bit of room in your finances so that you can, you know, take those on the chin and recover from them.
Yeah, no, I think from my point of view, there's probably comments I would make, and in line with what you both said is you need to risk manage your situation. You need to understand, play out the scenarios. If what happens if I get injured, I know this will sound morbid. I die, you die. What happens if I lose my job? What happens if we lose a tenant? All those things we've talked about today. What if interest rates go up? You really do need to spend some time working through all those issues and making sure that you've got a plan A, B, and C for them. Because the last thing you want to be doing is being a forced seller of any asset, because that can cause you an enormous amount of grief and lost equity very quickly, in particular in this environment. The second comment that I personally wanted to make today around borrowing to invest is clearly have a borrowing strategy and an investment strategy around it. I think there's a fair few people that over the past and in my time have just borrowed for the sake of borrowing and bought an asset for the sake of borrowing an asset and, sorry, buying an asset. And I think that passive just, oh, she'll be right attitude doesn't necessarily work. I think that if you're going to borrow money, and I mean admittedly, you know, 6 or 7% is a bit different to 2%, but that hurdle rate of return needs, you need to be beating that to make sure that you're getting in front. And I agree with you, Dylan, that completely there's never do it just for tax reasons. That's not a great reason to do it. We're doing it to make money and to create wealth. And if you're borrowing at 3 or 4% just to make 3 or 4 or 5%, that's probably not a great strategy. You know, if you're going to borrow money and take the risk, which as we all acknowledge, borrowing money to invest means your risk factors are higher, that you'd be wanting to get compensated for that a little bit more in it. So I've always seen borrowing as perhaps opportunistic. If you see a good deal, if you need somebody else's money to do something at short notice, and where you might make not just 4 or 5%, but you might be making 7, 8, 9, 10, 11%, and it's actually you've got some room to move there in terms of generating wealth. I think that's it's always good, and making sure your cash flow's spot on, which both of you gentlemen have talked about today. It is an interesting environment. You know, obviously the banks are going through an enormous amount of flux at the moment, and interesting even at the moment, as we're talking about off air, is the housing market in Adelaide has been pretty strong. You know, is there any last words of advice for people out there looking to either borrow or invest from both of you gents today?
Yeah, I personally think it's a fantastic time to own property. I'm a little bit biased. So got to do that disclaimer.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you can pay 2.5% or less than 3% and you're earning 5 or 6%, as long as your capital value is going up and not down, then you're getting ahead. So it's definitely worth looking at the moment, and just make sure you get the right advice from people like yourself and a good broker, just to make sure you're ticking all the right boxes.
Great. Dylan?
Look, I think borrowing to invest is a fantastic way to really kickstart your growth. And I think it's just key, you know, having a plan to do it, having a strategy. And if you do it right, especially, you know, low interest rates where they are at the moment, it definitely has the potential to, really grow your asset base.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think, and the other thing that I've always been a big fan of is that savings plan mechanism behind a gearing plan. I always, you know, making sure you get the dividends or rent and you sort of make it what I call wash its own face in a gearing plan is fantastic, and it can be a very powerful way of getting some people on their way for their wealth creation.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, a loan has a fantastic way of making people want to pay it down quickly. Yeah. And I think certainly with property investing, I mean, that's one of the powerful things is once there's a loan there's a real incentive, you know, to get rid of that. And that has an effect on what you do with your money and ultimately helps with that saving discipline that if you don't have the loan, you might not have.
Yeah, well, the money you don't see is the money you don't miss often with clients. So, gents, thanks, Greg, for coming in. Really great to have your insights on some of this stuff today, and Dylan as well. For those that are contemplating getting a loan to invest, speak to Greg down at Samuel Finance, and if you need any advice around it, speak to Dylan. So thanks, gents, and I look forward to catching up with you next time.
Thanks for having me,
Tony. Thanks. Cheers.